Hello, and welcome to the Blockchain.com podcast. My name is Nick Carey, co-founder and vice chairman of Blockchain.com. Blockchain Bylines is a new series from Blockchain.com providing industry insights and perspectives on recent developments from a crypto OG. Since 2011, Blockchain.com has been facilitating the adoption of cryptocurrency through its extensive suite of products, with 90 million wallets created on our platform to date, from the brokerage and wallet serving retail to a dedicated institutional team providing elegant solutions to investors with high-touch execution. In this series of monthly podcasts, the blockchain team will be reflecting on different areas of the industry, where we've been, where we are right now, and what we can expect moving forwards. Our guest today is Michael Casey, a prolific writer, researcher, and the former chief content officer at CoinDesk. In this episode, Michael kicks off our discussion by exploring the urgent situation we find ourselves in for the fight of the future of the free internet. Drawing from his expertise in economics, culture, and information technology, Michael shares his insights into his journey as a crypto author. He is the author of the critically acclaimed book, The Age of Cryptocurrency from 2015, The Unfair Trade 2012, and Chase Afterlife 2009. Michael dives into his evolution in writing style, as well as the lessons learned along the way. We're super excited to have him come here to talk about his new book. Michael, we have a little tradition around here. You got to tell us, how did you earn your first buck?
My first buck, right. Actually, I was thinking about this. I think it's probably even best to say my first 25 cents, and that's 25 cents Australian, as you can gather. I'm an Aussie. My uncle was a cheapskate clinician, a doctor. He had a private clinic, and rather than pay the Australian Post, whatever it was, 30 cents on each stamp that he was buying to send out the bills to his clients, he paid me, I think, something like 25 or 20 cents for every letter. It was probably even less, if I think about it, per letter for me to ride my bike all over the neighborhood dropping in these mails. And I think if I look back and thought about the expenditure of time that I put into it and the fact that I was being swooped by magpies as I dropped these letters off, and would have to sit there and sort through and organize my route and do everything else, it probably really wasn't worth the amount of effort that I was putting into. But I suppose I learned some lessons.
I love that. Some hazard pay, a little bit of negotiating an adverse environment. And yeah. You can certainly see the implications of inflation. 25 cents is a little penny wise there.
Yeah. I'm actually now thinking about it. I'm thinking in sort of contemporary terms. It was probably significantly less than 25 cents.
All right. From riding your bike, doing those things, to becoming a critically acclaimed author, talk to us sort of about the evolution of your writing style and also your focus and how it's crystallized on your new book here. And tell us a bit about that, our biggest.
Yeah. And let me just be very clear about the book as well. Of course, this is co-written with Frank McCourt. In fact, he is listed as the primary author. And I might just, in fact, this might be a segue into that question, but I was hired to help Frank on this book. Frank is a prominent civic entrepreneur. He made his money in construction and also known for sporting teams. He owned the LA Dodgers for a while and now owns Olympique de Marseille, the soccer team, football team out of Marseille. And Frank's been obsessed with the problems of the internet and, in fact, was the very first, I think, prominent mainstream business leader that I've met who really understood something that I've been obsessed with, which is, you know, the incentive structure of the internet being broken by these very large platforms and the undue influence they have over our lives. So we met, and then I was introduced to him again as somebody that would be able to help him. So I came in as the sort of the writer. Thankfully, this isn't a ghostwriting scenario. I am listed on the cover, so I can quite rightfully call it our book, my book with Frank. But I just want to be clear, he's the sort of the primary listed name on this. And yet, as I say, because this is what this conversation is going to go, this is not just me being hired to do any old writing exercise. This is, I would argue, my life work. And so it was a real nice marriage for the two of us to come together because I cared about it. So anyway, your question was about my writing style. Look, I think that over the years, I think the talent that I've brought to this is the ability to distill complex ideas into accessible prose. And I don't think that's just an explanatory thing. It's not just, okay, I'm going to break this down and explain. It's the art of storytelling. It's the art of connecting with people and giving them a way to actually understand it from a very personal perspective. So I like to weave personal stories into my writing. In this book, you'll find there's some of my own, some of Frank's and others. Anecdotes are useful. They are ways to give an allusion to something that allows us to have, we have an existing mental frame to then be able to absorb something complex in that regard. And just trying to strip away the jargon, right? And in fact, in this particular case, we were quite deliberate. You will probably have noticed, Nick, that there's really not actually a mention of the word blockchain or crypto in there. And yet we are talking about decentralized systems, which we all know inherently cannot exist without these sort of basic concepts of blockchains and crypto bring to this. Yeah, it's an exercise of simplifying, connecting, storytelling, and really personalizing, trying to connect with the reader and make sure that they can relate on a personal level to whatever it is you're writing about.
Thank you for putting it together. I think this book is extraordinarily timely. As we were discussing just before we started recording here, we spent some time last week in Denver, and the intersection of technology, decentralization, and artificial intelligence, it's all coming together right now, and it's not a coincidence. So this book is highly anticipated. You write and are basically telling us that we're facing arguably a kind of critical emergency, a technological and philosophical identity crisis. We're at this precipice. Can you talk to us about what got us here? What happened? And what are the conditions that have inspired you to write this book now?
Yeah, I don't think something as big as this is not necessarily by design. And I think the key word here is necessarily, right? I don't know that I'm pointing the finger and saying so-and-so did this. Although, as you will notice in the book, I think it's also very important us to point fingers and to name names. We specifically cite these five largest internet companies. And you've got, of course, you know, Google's Alphabet. You have, Alphabet's Google, whatever you wanted to frame that. You have Meta, Facebook. You have Amazon. You have Microsoft, and you have Apple. And it's no coincidence that these are the guys right now that are absolutely surging in terms of price and market cap because of their heavy investment and association with AI. Look, I think the evolution of the internet such that it wasn't that the founders of the internet were naive, but I do think that there wasn't sufficient preparation for how the incentive structures would get misaligned, and that once, to quote Marc Andreessen, software started eating the world, that the software-based systems, the algorithms that would be built on top of that otherwise decentralized base layer internet architecture would inherently lead toward the monopolization of power, and that because of human nature, largely, and we go into this into the book, our dopamine release function, there would be both incentives and the ability for these sort of misaligned, incentivized entities to build such significant network effect and control and then use that in a profit extracting way from us. That was almost like an inevitability because of the sort of the nature of capitalism. And this is not a knock on capitalism, but it is a knock on the idea that if we don't think hard about the way capitalist systems emerge, where there is excessive monopolistic control, then the incentives that capitalism has built in it will drive toward these sorts of problems. And there needs to be mechanisms, whether they are private sector or public sector, to push back against that excessive control. And that's why, of course, I've been excited about crypto and blockchains for some time as a way to push back a bit against that centralizing instinct.
Yeah, so excessive monopolistic control has led to these excessive monopolistic rent-seeking institutions, but broadly, rent-seeking institutions on our data itself that we are giving away for free. And I think this sort of sets the tone for, you know, why the internet may be broken today, especially compared to its original promise of empowering individuals. And I want to spend a little time with you talking a bit about the importance of how individuals interact with technologies, why sovereignty is so critical. Mm-hmm. Can you give us a little bit of your perspective, especially studying this sort of historical trend and how it's been abused basically in the last decade?
Well, you touched on something in the preamble to that I think is important here, specifically when it comes to the nature of the internet. And that is this idea of people perceiving that it was free, right? I've always thought that Bruce Schneier's famous quip was probably one of the most important little succinct statements ever made about the internet. Like, you are not Facebook's. If something is free, you are not Facebook's customer, you are its product. And I think that is a key part of the psychological challenge here, is that we don't have the mental model to understand. We didn't have the mental, hopefully now we do, and our book is partly the process. By the way, I'm going to be a little bit shilly here and show it, because it's right here. It's called Our Biggest Fight, and Our Biggest Fight, Reclaiming Liberty, Humanity, and Dignity in the Digital Age. Our book is partly to try to get over this original sin that we thought it was free. And I don't think neither the users nor regulators, nor even most of people in technology understood the degree to which we actually were paying all the time, right? That we were delivering up our data, and our data being this vital commodity. And in such a way that data was not just being sold, but was actually being accumulated in a way that could then be used against us surreptitiously, indirectly, to manipulate our behavior and drive us into certain activities. That is a massive cost, right? We've borne that cost in all sorts of ways, whether it's the rise in teen suicides or the dysfunction in our democracy or the incapacity really to agree on a common truth, right? All of that is a huge societal and individual cost, but we didn't see it. We thought, wow, look at Google. Google is just getting better and better. They keep giving us free services. I've got GPS services, I've got home services, I've got Gmail, I've got everything, and it's all free. Isn't this wonderful? So I think that is the fundamental breakdown that we found in the internet. And to get more to your specific question, I think that perhaps one of the elements, this, I wish I could remember who said it, but the famous line about any good technology is inseparable from magic, right? This idea that it's supposed to be in the background. It's supposed to just happen, and we don't quite know how it happens. I don't understand the internal combustion engine, and I happily get in the car and put my foot on the pedal and drive the thing. And I think that's the way that we've been developed, and we should actually develop with technology. We don't want to necessarily have the general public be understanding the ins and outs of everything and how it works. We want to just accept it and use it as it is. I think human beings approach all technologies that they eventually come around to trusting, for whatever reason, with that superficial higher level acceptance. They want to use it. This is why we obsess with the UX and the UI as being fundamental in the development. You've been a founder for some time, Nick, and getting that UX right is important because people don't want to have to deal with the clunky ins and outs. If that's done honestly and done without any manipulation, that's great. But if it's done in a way that the UX looks and feels great, but underneath the hood, there is this really horrible machine that's eating away at us, then you've been duped. You've been treated as a pawn, really. So I think that we need to be honest. Frank, actually, in his book, talks, it's interesting. He's a builder, right? He spent his life building buildings, building infrastructure. And he talks passionately about the idea that, you know, if you built a building and you deliberately built it in such a way that it wasn't safe for the human beings living in it, you couldn't call yourself a builder. That the idea of the strength of the foundations.
Right. It would be a coffin.
And in fact, we've got hundreds and hundreds of years of building codes that have been developed that are the standards by which builders build. And of course, there's all sorts of untrustworthy construction engineers out there. But as an industry, it doesn't build a building for the sake of manipulating and making people's lives horrible. You don't accept the cost of the harm done to people as something that is integral to the business proposition here. He's quite passionate about that. And he, in fact, pushes back against that classic Silicon Valley aphorism of move fast and break things. Really, that's not what we should. In the case of when you're dealing with human lives like this, you really need to be thinking hard about the safety of them. So I think that there's sort of two ways of looking at your question. Right? One is the idea that human beings are naturally going to be trusting if they're going to use this, because technology, and certainly once we get into the world of AI, the further we get down the technology spectrum, right, the more and more impossible it is for anybody to fully understand. Even the engineers building these generative AI systems don't understand how they're working now. So the further we get on that spectrum, the harder it is to actually understand that. And that's okay. That's the nature of the way we operate with technology. But we've got to think hard, therefore, about what are the principles, the foundations upon which that technology is built, so that this natural accepting aspect of the way human beings deal with it is not evolving in a way that's going to do enormous harm.
More harm than good. And I wanted to ask you a question. If there was to be essentially a do no harm principle or a Hippocratic oath for AI development, how would you imagine that could look like if we were to spend a little bit of time pausing and thinking about the substrate of equal access to these data sets? We're seeing already pretty concerning evidence that these models have been not only trained on sometimes private data, but then that data has been weighted in specific ways, and then it has been passed through arguably compliance departments or ethicist groups. And then when prompted and to develop inference on simple questions, these systems are hallucinating, and they're hallucinating responses to questions, whether it relates to history or science. And you talk about truthful drift. We're already arguing about basic fact patterns, and we were 5-6 years ago. And now these systems that we're taking for granted, that you said human beings, through a false sense of wonder, through the magic of these things, have been allured to them. But these things are condescending and they're lying to us. And how did we get to that? If you were to maybe opine about both those questions around a Hippocratic oath for AI and then you know, maybe what this drift could really do, what's the danger here if we don't address this soon?
So I love the concept. The Hippocratic oath is really interesting. I wouldn't suggest it's wrongly framed, but let me point out where we probably need to go outside of that framing a little bit, right? Because the Hippocratic Oath is about the responsibility of one person, the doctor, right? Or maybe it's the hospital, the institution. It recognizes that. I think that really the essence of what, whether we call it a Hippocratic Oath or the founding principles of what AI modeling should be built upon going forward are, it is that it has to be open sourced, that it has to be open sourced, and that we have to have some understanding of the input output garbage in garbage out problem, that we need provenance of data. And also then on top of that, the economic piece of this, that there needs to be some understanding and some reckoning with the fact that the real the product, the value that's being input into these mechanisms is actually the output of the human beings who've generated that data. And that therefore there's got to be some mechanism for rewarding them. Is that UBI? I'm not a fan of UBI, but is it a means of payment? Is it some other sort of share in what this is all about? So there's a lot of pieces to this, but I think it's like, in fact, I think some people would take your question, Nick, and turn that into a sort of a fulcrum of power. And I think that's in fact what a lot of big tech is doing, right? Like you're getting Sam Altman, no dig on Sam, by the way, but just again, the structure of the way these things work, holding countless meetings with Congress. You're getting Mark Zuckerberg and other execs for these big platforms giving testimony. And they're essentially saying, yeah, we get it. AI is dangerous. It could evolve into something quite frightening. Trust us. We'll fix it. And you're literally getting people. You saw Andreessen and Kostler have a Twitter fight about this the other day saying, would you trust, I think Kostler's line was, would you trust the Manhattan Project with open source to be open source the Manhattan Project? You need to have these sort of trusted entities in the middle of this. And I think we're way beyond that.
I'm so glad you brought that up. I saw that discussion. And to compare this to the development of the Manhattan Project is completely insincere. The permeability of the work, the way the data is really the raw material is coming from all of humanity, it's a completely different conversation. Yeah. And there's, by the way, there's no putting the cat back in the bag here anyway. And so I think the most, and it's so true, the most dangerous words in the human language are trust us.
Trust me.
Trust me. And when I hear that, it makes me cringe and I get really worried because these magicians and these conjurers of ethics and integrity spin these complex tales to our policymakers, and we're approaching this
in a way that will almost guarantee an adverse outcome. You put a lot of control over a lot of censored data without anybody understanding how it works or how to use it, except for a corporation or a power system that seeks to exist in perpetuity for its own interests, you are going to have very bad outcomes for the regular people in the world. And yeah, thank you for bringing that up.
I think that's why the lessons of Web 2 are so important, right? We know from what these big five platforms have done with the data that they control. Data, by the way, that's, I think this is something else that we'll get talking about here, but is intricately connected to who we are as human beings and how that's been used, because their incentives are structured that way. They want to meet quarterly targets. They've got shareholders who see these sort of big returns and want to maintain them. And so if it works, they keep doing it. And that's why you can't trust them, because they're not actually aligned with our interests. And I think there's just no way, when you're dealing with such massive data sets involving basically every human being on the planet, that you could possibly say, trust me, right? It's trust you with that. That is the biggest responsibility one could ever have in the entire world. And by the way, again, your incentives are not aligned with me trusting, being able to trust you. So we've just got to just throw this idea out. I was really one of these people that was very upset about the whole pause letter that came out. AI is going to destroy us. I think it could, right? But it was clear that was used by these institutions to say, therefore, regulate us and build this sort of regulatory capture around our pre-existing models, closed and manipulated. Like, the only way to confront this is to open this up, to build provenance, to build incentive structures that are aligned with everybody's interests, and to essentially give some transparency to this process. That, I think, is the only way. And I'm hoping that things like these flubs we're seeing, the hallucinations, as you put it, the crazy Google Gemini African-American founding father thing, we should be able to understand that this is the problem, that they can't, you can't fix, 12 people in a room cannot fix something as complex as 20 years of internet human being data sets. It's just, it's a massive complexity problem. And the only way to deal with it is with complexity, but complexity with transparency, complexity with, and that's, this is where a lot of the technologies that have been developed by the crypto and blockchain community get really interesting.
How do you address critics out there that say there's always been this dynamic between technology being developed and corporations and even nation states oscillating between centralization and then decentralization? Is this just a trend of time and we're going to see this happen in perpetuity? It's just a cycle we always experience? Or is it a little bit different this time?
No, I think it is. I think it takes it to another extreme this time, but it's always this oscillation. Look, centralization it emerges because it's efficient, because power always harkens towards monopoly. And not a bad thing, right? That, in fact, the competition that we know is the value of a market system has this tension where you want markets to be open and free and have many actors all competing for the best outcome. But each of those actors is trying to be the one, to be the monopoly, right? That's the nature of the struggle. It's what drives people forward. So our responsibility as a society is to think about, okay, how do we build systems that encourage that the innovation that drives people towards those outcomes, but looks at the substrate, the underlying system, and says, this part of it needs to be open. This part of it needs to be a commons. It needs to have competition, essentially, and sort of have structures in place that protect that. Now, traditionally, nation states have looked at that from a regulatory perspective, and clearly, I'm a supporter of things like antitrust. And I think Teddy Roosevelt was one of the great presidents of the United States who understood that the power of the market actually would thrive if you tried to put constraints on monopolistic power. So I think that with a mindset that or a framing that says, let's keep this part open and free and allow where it can be safe, you know, monopoly or at least dominance or success to thrive. And I think that was the framing of the original of the internet, right? Clearly, the founding fathers of the internet wanted the capacity to move information around to make it free. And that was, there was this sort of very philosophical view of information that it needed to be free. This was like an anti-copyright concept, really. And there's a long tradition of thought that we shouldn't put a price on information. I'm a journalist and an author, and I've made my money selling information in various ways. And this is where the ad model got interesting. But it is an interesting framing that they came up with. And what I suppose wasn't seen is then how do we deal with data? Data became this other element to it, and we really needed. And this is what our book is really trying to stress here. We need to break down that aspect of the monopolistic power over data. This, we need data now to be treated as if it too, just like the underlying protocols of the internet, TCP/IP and so forth, these sort of packet switching concepts that were open source and free, we now need to be thinking similarly about a public commons with regards to data. And that to me is the next phase of what we're talking about here, right? Okay, this is the substrate that belongs to the commons. What business models, what exciting competitive things can be built on top of that? Because right now, data is treated as if it is a private right for these big five platforms, and that is extremely problematic.
I couldn't agree anymore. When I think about it, basically the last 150 years from the first industrial revolution onward was really all about reorganizing the world's atoms, physical goods, raw materials. And now we're entering this completely new era where we have to think very carefully about how we organize the world's electrons and the world's information. And the internet had this promise to basically help us exchange information and build this intelligence. And what happened was we created all of this content and we repurposed all of our knowledge and we digitized it. And then all of our behaviors, all of that data were really accumulated in these small silos that have been weaponized against us. And we've lost really control over the truth telling. We've lost control over storytelling and narrative, becoming harder, like you said, to really find truth and common ground. People are lonelier than ever. Like you mentioned, suicides are up.
Yeah.
These are very serious externalities to some of the promise of the original open internet. And I think you've made some exceptional points around thinking about the substrate and that access to data. And as we come maybe to the conclusion of this, you end your book with a chapter, Control, Alt, Delete, Escape, which are old keystrokes for those who use keyboards still, famous keystrokes. How do we navigate this precipice, this technological adolescence that we're in without enslaving ourselves to algorithmic overlords for all eternity? What are going to be the messages that we have to get through to our political, religious and other spiritual leaders to think through what it means to have open access to our own information and how it gets used and how we're compensated for it? What are the things people should be thinking about?
Yeah, let's break down what I meant by that title, that chapter. And I need to shout out to a guy called David Quirk, who's a fascinating Irish dude, creative lead for U2, in fact, the band, who gave this idea to me. And he's been a passionate supporter of fixing the internet for some time because of problems that you know, he's seen in people connected with him in their lives.
Thank you for that story.
Yeah, no, it's great. David's a character. But so the idea is like, take control of your data, migrate to an alternative model, delete the old system, and escape to a better world. So it's very sort of a warming, positive, we can do this together thing. But what we're really talking about is, for want of a better word, a revolution, but a bloodless revolution. Because you've read the book, Nick, we do frame the book around the concept of the American project. It's called Our Biggest Fight for a reason, that this is really about establishing a new society for the digital age. It's not, or at least a new framework for how we organize society within the digital age. We don't really want to change who we are and how we act and everything else, but we certainly need to come up with a model that is consistent with this internet data-driven digital experience that we now live. So we need to be thinking like the founding fathers of the United States. What is the actual framework for how an individual's rights are protected? What is the framework for how we actually react with each other? We call this the responsibilities of a society, right? So rights, responsibilities, rewards. What is our market structure in this environment? How do you incentivize? What are the right incentives, rewards? And then rules, the governance, right? So we looked at all of that. And what we're trying to say is the good thing is, unlike the revolutionaries in 1776, there's really, you don't need to go out and die for this. There's no real threat to life necessarily. We do think there's going to be a big fight with these massively well-funded institutions who are going to come at us with lawsuits and everything else. But at the end of the day, this is a little easier than what we had to do there, because the technologies do exist, right? We have self-sovereign systems that have been built. We have W3C approved standards now, the DID standard for control of data and being able to permission that data. And that's really what we're trying to say. So this is the technology that Frank is championing and we are using as the framework for what we're arguing is the future here in this book is something called DSNP. It's the Decentralized Social Network Protocol. I think both Frank and I would say we're open to all sorts of alternatives. This isn't a shill of that technology. It's an open source, free. It's not tokenized. It's thought of another protocol to insert into the stack alongside HTTP, alongside SDMP and TCP IP, et cetera. One that establishes the power of anybody who is interacting online to be able to tag, permission, and control any single message that they give, whether it's a post or a follow or any sort of relationship. So all the stuff that goes into what Mark Zuckerberg famously called the social graph, this incredibly powerful, important pool of data about who we are and our and most importantly, our connections with each other, anything that goes into that, we are now in charge of. And what we do is we build relationships through that, and they are on our terms with each other. We're building permission systems. It doesn't mean that everything's hidden and private. In fact, we may well just choose to push things into the public zone, and we would encourage that. We think the data being able to be shared publicly that we feel comfortable with, our DNA data, for example, encrypted but available for researchers everywhere, no longer controlled by siloed entities, could unlock phenomenal medical innovation, right? So we're trying to think through a structure that does this. It's not going to snap our fingers. We have a network effect challenge because everybody wants to be where everybody is. But the fact of the matter is there are these technologies available. There are products built on DSNP, such as MeWe, which is a social media alternative. And there's no reason why loads of other companies could migrate to it as well, because what I think is exciting is that it's not just little old Michael Casey and Nick Carey who are being manipulated here by the system. It's companies, right? I'm a media guy. I've been in journalism all my life. I've been baffled why large media companies have given over all their data and been beholden to the powers of these social media platforms and not thought, why don't we get all that back and forge a model in which we can now talk once again directly with our audience rather than having that whole structure, that whole relationship intermediated by these entities who are not sharing our interests. It's harmed democracy. It's harmed the quality of the press. It's harmed everything else. So I would argue that this control, alt, delete, escape concept is not just for individuals, it's for companies. And we could actually build a dynamic, innovative new economy. Think of the innovation that happened in the 90s when we broke down the monopolies of the baby bells and we let the internet flourish before the social media era took charge of it all and changed the dynamics. Right? If we break open the data, if we see the data as something akin to that same gatekeeping power that the telecoms had, we're going to unlock incredible innovation on top of this. So I think that's what control, alt, delete, escape's about. It's about us taking charge. If Paul Revere and Anthony Hale and all these guys could put their lives at the line to create a better, more promising society for human beings in the 1770s, then why can't we all do this now? Why don't we take charge of this, use the technology that's available for us, and build a new digital future that's built for humans, not for these rapacious machines.
I love it. And I think that optimistic perspective is one that resonates deeply with me. There's the founding fathers and so many of those contributors, a different governance model, did some heavy, hard thinking. And they wanted to make sure that individual rights were enshrined in how we interact with each other. And there's this quote from the Federalist I'll read, in framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed. In the next place, oblige it to control itself.
Yeah.
Dependence on the people is, no doubt, the primary control on the government, but the experience has taught mankind the necessity of auxiliary precautions. Huh. And in this case, the auxiliary precautions are to decentralize access to the information that we have all helped create and that has been captured and siloed in these rent-seeking parasitic systems that are causing all kinds of negative externalities to mankind and threaten our future of understanding of our democracies, our relationship with each other, of our understanding of truth and more. I'm very grateful for your thought-provoking interview with me today, Michael, and your book. I'm hopeful will make waves right now as it is extraordinarily timely, specifically as governments and these large tech platforms are lobbying at this exact moment to actually sink their hands into these things more aggressively than ever. And it's a little bit like in maybe the Star Wars universe, the tighter they grip, the more systems will slip through their fingers. And I'm hopeful that by embracing decentralization, embracing individual sovereignty, embracing an incentive model that ultimately rewards the creators of the content and the data that can enable the breakthroughs that would be so beneficial to society, whether in biotech, health, or how we learn or more, we can get this right. But we really need to come at it from a first principles perspective. And I really appreciate your contribution along with Frank's to this discourse. And it's so timely at this moment. So thank you very much.
Tremendous. Thanks for having me, Nick.
All right. Please remember to subscribe to our channel and leave a review if you enjoyed today's episode. Until next time, I'm Nicholas Carey on behalf of the entire Blockchain.com team. Thank you for tuning in.
The views and opinions expressed in this podcast are for institutional and informational purposes only and should not be considered as financial advice. Listeners are encouraged to conduct their own research and consult with a qualified financial professional before making any investment decisions.